Perfect Union, a podcast about the joy we get from American politics, or as we like to call it, real debate without the hate. Hello, I'm Kevin Kelton. I'm a moderate Democrat, and I live in Los Angeles, California.
Hello, I'm Molly Malloy Cooper. I'm a free market conservative and senior instructor of economics at The Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio.
I'm DJ McGuire, your conservative Democrat from Suffolk, Virginia.
I'm Greg Matuszak, your liberal Democrat and veteran of many political campaigns from Cincinnati, Ohio.
And I'm Cliff Dunn, a Republican Party unit chair from Newport News, Virginia.
And the More Perfect Union can now be heard on Blog Talk Radio, iTunes, iHeartRadio, YouTube, Facebook, and at our website, moreperfectunionpodcast.com, where you can also find host bios and written commentaries. DJ has been doing a great job of posting lots of new material there. DJ, you posted one this week about the New Deal. Do you want to just briefly tell us what that was about?
Yes, I posited the theory that the New Deal, rather than actually being a departure from the Democratic Party's history of racism, was actually the culmination of it, and that it very much created a welfare state for white people. And we have been dealing with the consequences of both the Democrats forming that New Deal and the Republicans accepting it a generation later ever since.
I really enjoyed that article. And, you know, for even as a Democrat, I was like completely dug that article. Great job, by the way.
But we're going to start this week with news that came out just after we recorded last week's show. And it was the Las Vegas shooting. And, of course, we're still wrapping our metaphorical arms and heads around what happened in Las Vegas last week. Greg, I mean, is there any takeaway on this, whether it's, you know, legislation, whether it's mental health treatment? I mean, what do you think is the big takeaway, or what do you see happening on this?
You know, we didn't do anything after Sandy Hook, where 26 children were killed.
By the way, can I just jump in? I know that that was an honest mistake to make. It was 20 children killed and 26 individuals altogether.
Okay, I apologize for that. But when 20 children were killed, but with that in mind, we just have to then say, at what number will we decide that we do need? Will the America be shocked that we need better gun safety legislation? Will we stop doing things like bump stocks, and will we do automatic or semi-automatic and assault rifles, which no one needs? It's ridiculous.
Now I need to jump in here because what this showed me is that somebody with enough time and enough resources, money, etc., can, you know, who really wants to cause a mass casualty incident is going to do so, whether or not there's gun control. This guy, even though he was obviously disturbed, there was no reason for the mental health system to pick him up. So a check there wouldn't have done anything. He had no criminal record. So, those rules wouldn't have done anything. The guns were illegally modified from semi-automatic to automatic.
They were legally modified.
No. There was one gun where, as I recall, a bump stock was used, which was, by the way, an administrative agency oversight, given that you don't allow automatic weapons. Allowing a device that makes a semi-automatic weapon into an automatic weapon probably should not have been authorized. But hey, we leave it to administrative agencies with no real oversight. They'll never screw anything up.
So then what is the fix, Cliff? I mean, are you suggesting stronger gun safety legislation?
Yeah, there is no fix because, you know, with the amount of money that this guy spent on this, which I believe the estimate is probably over 100,000, possibly over 200,000, given the cost of the weapons. Given that he was a pilot, for that price, he could have bought a DC-3, packed it full of fertilizer, and flown it into the crowd.
But fertilizer has been regulated since Timothy McVeigh. You can't buy that much fertilizer.
Right, but if it's years in the making, you can buy that much fertilizer and stockpile it. If you are patient and you have resources.
Yes, so what this guy would have done is he would have gone out, he would have bought a loss leader farm somewhere, and he would have used that to cover surplus fertilizer purchases. Nothing way too above the above board, but at the same time, more than he actually needed, and he would have stockpiled the surplus for, again, 2 or 3 years, given that he was clearly willing to spend a lot of time on this. And lo and behold, you know, you can get something together over time. Basically,
your argument, and I'll ask you back because it shows that I'm listening because I am, is because many people say you're not listening and I'm just not talking about my wife or kids. Well, your argument is we can't really stop them by regulating automatic and assault rifles. So why bother? Why save like maybe the 10 people or the 5 people who don't have $100,000 or who get angry and maybe only shoot up a coffee shop, who maybe don't have 15 years and $200,000, who just get angry?
The issue there is that those attackers aren't going to actually pull off something on the scale of what this guy did, because, you know, in order to pull off something like this, you either need multiple weapons, you need to modify those weapons, again, either using items that even the NRA has agreed should not have been legalized in the first place, or illegally modifying the weapons, which, you know, once something is in somebody's hands, you know, it's illegal, but you can't necessarily stop them from modifying it.
So all right, well, let's catch common ground first. Do you believe that assault rifles, the AR-15, the any like M16 type weapon, should those
flag on the play, illegal conflation of weaponry on Greg, that's a 10-yard penalty. Repeat the down.
No, because I think I'm using the correct lexicon here.
You are conflating
an AR-15
two very different types of weapons. An M16 is an automatic weapon specifically designed for military use. An AR-15 is just about the most common rifle that is sold in the United States today. This is part of the problem that a lot of people on the gun control side have, is that they assume that semi-automatic, because it's a long fancy name, is somehow exotic and strange and unusual. Semi-automatic is just about the most common form of weapon that's out there. All it means is you.
But I didn't say semi-automatic.
Yes,
I said assault rifle.
Semi-automatic before, and if you mentioned the AR-15,
okay, fair
enough.
The
AR-15 is a semi-automatic rifle. Semi-automatic rifles are about the most common form of weapon out there. Automatic weapons, by contrast, have been largely banned since 1986, and as Cliff mentioned, one of the only reasons the bump stock was essentially allowed was because someone in the Obama administration didn't quite understand what a bump stock would do. They probably figured, oh, well, they'll just all be in Mexico anyway as part of our Operation Fast and Furious, perhaps. but the fact of the matter is, it's come back to haunt them. It's why just about everyone in the gun rights community, including the National Rifle Association itself, has said, yeah, we can probably do without bump stocks. But if you're going to try to go into banning any sort of semi-automatic weapon, you're essentially going to go after weapons that are going after the vast majority of guns that are in existence. And it may be something that Kevin wants. He's been very open about that. But I don't think it's something that most of the American people would accept in this circumstance.
I don't know about that. I honestly don't know. Is there a reason that you need an AR-15? You can't hunt with them. You can't defend your house with them. You really can't defend a house from burglary with an AR-15. You are more likely to shoot someone in your house with an AR-15. If you ever shot an AR-15, you will know that in a small, like a living room, you're going to shoot anyone across. It's not useful.
Greg, part of the problem is that you're conflating with, the AR-15 versus numerous other weapons, which cover a very broad range, as DJ has indicated, that fall under the same umbrella. And trying to get that legislation straight, well, we saw how well that worked out with the 1994 gun ban.
Let's just talk about the AR-15, which is the most sold gun in America. Okay, it's a semi-automatic.
No, the problem with trying to talk about the AR-15 is, okay, you pass a bill saying we ban the AR-15. Okay, somebody's going to come up with a very strangely similar gun that looks a whole lot like the AR-15, but it's not the AR-15 because you named the AR-15 in that bill, and that was actually the problem with the 1994
bill. Fair enough. So tell me right now, Do you think the AR-15 is a gun that should be legal? Yes.
Yes.
On what grounds and
because
why?
Because as a semi-automatic weapon, it is not of the same class as an automatic weapon, which is basically squeeze and forget. For an AR-15, for any semi-automatic weapon, you have to pull the trigger each time for a shot. That allows a sort of user control that you don't have with automatic weaponry. And that is part of a consensus that has been part of the American consensus since 1986. And it was part of the consensus that triumphed in 2004 when the assault weapons ban, which was as poorly written as Cliff said it was not allowed to be renewed. Now, the fact of the matter is, when it comes to this sort of thing, in my opinion, we have spent far too much time focusing on the gun and less time focusing on the people. And that is why I think we need to take a step back and take a broader view here. You know, we have to look at what are we doing regarding a serious investigation and look at white supremacist terrorism. We still don't know what this guy's motive is. Okay, it is quite possible that this could
at
have been
a country
an act of white supremacist
music
terror.
Festival.
We don't know.
No, he was just a murderer. Okay, and I do agree we have to work on the people.
I refuse. At this point, when this guy has absolutely no motive, I refuse to automatically assume that every person at a country music festival is white and therefore that it was going to be something else. And regardless of what this particular incident is, the fact of the matter is we do have a problem with white supremacist terrorism. We don't know how well these groups are connected to each other. We don't know what foreign
Preach.
Support they're getting. May I remind you that just about every white supremacist party in Europe either has gotten direct support from the Russian government or is widely admirous of the Russian government. Numerous white supremacists in this country have talked about praising Vladimir Putin and their ties to Putin and Alexander Dugin, who's one of Putin's Svengalis over there. Okay. We don't know what we don't know about this. We know far more about Wahhabist-based terrorism, about Baathist-based terrorism, than we know about white supremacist-based terrorism. That's the first gap we need to address. The second thing is, and I'm going to monopolize time, and I'm sorry, but I'm going to reference the post I wrote on the More Perfect Union website about a day after this happened, which is we need to actually remember the first part of the Second Amendment, which was the discussion of a well-regulated militia. That wasn't just there for the hell of it. The framers and the founding generation understood that security should be a collective responsibility. And I think we've spent far too much time outsourcing this to various organizations such as local police and National Guard troops, which is essentially the state version of a standing army. And we as a people have become far less able to defend ourselves and to defend each other. And returning the well-regulated militia, I think, would address that. And I think it would provide a certain larger amount of control, if not a direct state control, and certainly a greater community control and a civic society control over the number and type of weaponry. It won't necessarily make Kevin completely happy because it's not state regulation, but it would provide a layer of organization, a layer of examination, and a layer of control that might make us feel – make many Americans feel a little more comfortable about it. And at the very least, it would make us all, I hope, and I include myself in this, better able to defend ourselves and to defend each other when something weird like this happens. We need another layer of collective security, one that derives from we the people. And we don't have that right now.
So DJ, I want to go ahead and ask you, what form would you see this taking? You've put out a very interesting concept that I actually haven't heard you elaborate on before, and I'd like you to actually say, okay, what form should this take?
It could be either something at the state or local level. Probably situations where at the local level you might have captains and majors. Maybe you would have them choose colonels and generals at the state level, perhaps, or if you want to keep it at a colonel. I know local police forces stop at colonels, or at least they do here in Virginia. I don't know if they'd go beyond that. But you would have that sort of thing that would essentially be much like, you know, charitable organization networks, civic league networks, the kinds of things that we see in civic society all the time. We see it for everything except self-protection.
Okay, so since my name was brought up, I want to respond to this. First of all, as DJ pointed out, I am probably of the five of us the one that leans further in the gun safety regulation argument as a proponent of gun safety legislation and doing away with guns. I probably lean further than Greg, or for that matter, the people that aren't here, such as Rebecca, who I'm sure also would be a strong proponent of that. In terms of this idea, DJ, you know, one of the things that I really do love about you is you are an iconoclast is what I meant to say, and an original thinker. You think out of the box all the time, and as a writer, I'm fascinated by that. You have a great mind, and you know there's a big butt coming right now.
Of course.
And the butt is
once I go outside the box, I don't know how to get back. I get that.
It's that I think the idea is ludicrous. I think the idea of adding what you call another layer and trying to somehow formalize militias in this country would just add to our problems. Look, I'm not going to say anything right now that is going to turn anybody's heads. I'm not going to say anything that's going to change anyone's mind. I'm a classic gun safety advocate. I believe less guns is a safer society. I believe we can regulate weapons. I don't believe we're going to undo people's Second Amendment rights by going back to things like the 1994 weapons ban, which I know you can cite statistics all day. I think it served a purpose in this country. And it, by the way, as a piece of legislation, it wasn't perfect either. There were loopholes. There's no doubt about that. But what I've heard for the last about 18 minutes here, in my opinion, is just masturbatory discussion that's getting us no place. Greg opens his mouth on the subject, and you guys can't wait to jump in to show how much smarter that you are, because you know the difference between a semi-automatic and an AR-15 versus an M16. That gets us no place. There is a problem in this country because too many people get too many weapons and use them to kill too many people. And if you can't see that, you are blind. And I don't care how many college degrees you get. I don't care how many colleges you teach at. But if you don't understand that there is a correlation between too many guns and guns that are too powerful for a civilized society, and what we've been seeing for the last 5 to 10 to 20 years in this country, the problem is yours, not mine. It's on you.
Yeah, you are wrong, because the worst school death incident in this country was Bath, Michigan, explosives. The worst terrorist incident used planes.
And we regulated them. What part of that don't you get?
Yes, and yet somehow that didn't stop
that
Murrah
didn't
building
stop.
Bombing from happening.
That didn't stop. Tell me about the second 9/11, Cliff. I forget about it. Tell me about the 9/11 that happened after 2001. There was none, because we regulated the airlines. We reinforced cockpit doors. We changed the rules around box cutters. We have a no-fly list now. We created the TSA. We anticipated a problem and changed the volume of liquids that passengers can carry on an airliner. We did things to make sure there wasn't another 9/11. But we are too afraid as a society to ask how many semi-automatic weapons with bump stocks and silencers one lunatic should be allowed to own. That's the problem.
What I think is important here, and what I think listeners should take away from this, and because this is something that in a lot of cases when people are discussing about this, I don't think a lot of people are arguing about guns and gun regulations and everything right now. What I think people are doing are they are having mutual reinforcing conversations with themselves. I think far fewer Americans are doing what we are actually doing here, which is talking across the divide. I'm seeing a lot more people talk within their own divides. So there are far few, if any, people on, say, the gun rights side who generally even understand that the folks on the gun regulation side believe this is the only way they can save human beings. For many folks on the gun rights side, it's about
freedom.
It's about gun seizures. It's about control. It's
right.
about hate. It's about hatred of us and all sorts of things that really
may or may not have anything to do with what's actually going on the gun regulation side. But the fact that the gun regulators are genuinely worried about more people dying than they think should die is something that we on the gun rights side need to take into account. What I think the folks on the gun regulation side don't quite recognize is that for most of us on the gun rights side, the people that the gun regulation side trust to protect them, we don't really trust to protect us.
Well, that is a big problem. That is a big problem.
Yeah,
and it's been said, gosh, I wish I could remember who said it on CNN, but you know who it was. But they said, it was Joe Scarborough on MSNBC who made the point today. He said, look, when I talk to my friends who are pro-gun advocates, and when we're not on the record, when they're talking from their hearts of hearts, they will acknowledge this is all about, I want to have my guns when the government comes for me. This is all about an armed insurrection that people in their heads think they someday may have to be a part of to protect America from whatever boogeyman they think it is, whether it's Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. It's insanity.
And bizarrely enough, Kevin, that is in part where I came up with the militia idea as this sort of collective, not state driven, but civic society driven by governments to put down insurrections and not the other way around. And it was my hope that if we were able to bring militias back, more Americans would recognize what their roles actually are and what their roles as American citizens are through history. The notion that someone with a gun is going to knock down an entire federal tyranny is kind of silly. The notion that enough people with guns can knock over local tyranny, that's happened all throughout history. There are counties that literally have their own local wars due to that in history. Anything except what the ordinary people wanted. That sort of history has not necessarily, it hasn't really gone away. It's just been bizarrely directed at the federal government. And the fact of the matter is, again, for a lot of, there's just a tremendous disconnect that we are now trying to bridge. And as the listeners will hear, as they are hearing, it's not an easy thing to bridge, but we have to keep trying. We have to keep talking to each other.
I would also add that conservatives tend to be more think about things less emotionally, more rationally. I mean, on average,
I'm very emotional
you know, about this, but I just think that wicked,
you know, you can so. Regulate guns, but it always comes down to, again, murderous intent. And there's a whole lot of ways of killing people and a whole lot of ways of killing a lot of people. And there's a whole lot of ways of making guns these days. You know, I mean, we are not that far away from them being printed out. And, you know, we have to address those root causes.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, from a point of view, like, it's rather than passing a law, and again, this might be very anti-conservative, but, you know, in terms of red flags on people that own 50 guns, I mean, I don't even know if that should be a law, because I don't know that people should know exactly how many guns we're looking for. Because if we're going to flag everyone with 50 guns, somebody's going to buy right up to 49 guns.
I agree with you. I don't think a number is the answer. I agree.
Yeah, I mean, I'm reminded by way of an analogy of a story that in Calcutta, you could only have three rickshaws in your name. So there was this guy who every relative out to like 4 degrees owned three rickshaws so that he had this large rickshaw company. So, you know, as far as ways to get around.
Of course there's ways to get around things. Of course. But you know what? But as a society, we still try. We have tax laws. People find loopholes. That doesn't mean we stop collecting taxes.
Okay? We haven't started talking about Donald Trump yet.
Now, what do you guys think of the rumor of the suicide pact that Tillerson and Kelly and Mattis have all agreed that if one goes, all three go, and that's like a backstop to make sure that Trump doesn't do anything you know, crazy, like firing Tillerson.
Crazier.
Yeah. Okay. Do you think there's any truth in that, or you think that's just a wild rumor? See, I believe all this stuff. If it comes out, it came from somebody, you know? I mean, there's some pretty good fiction writers in this country, but I don't think they're working at NBC News.
Yeah, I, it does make a certain amount of sense in, shall we say, the current context of Washington, especially since I suspect that there's a very good chance, especially with Mattis, that you have some congressmen who would basically turn around and say, you know, if Mattis got pushed out somehow, no, you have one choice for that job and it's Mattis. We're putting him back in. Nobody else is getting confirmed. I could actually see that happening with that specific post.
I can't wait to see the Trump administration when the DVD comes out with director commentary. Because that's going to be awesome. You know, where we just get like the
I actually think we're all looking at this the wrong way. I think this may actually be Kelly's way of trying to get as many triggers as he can so that he can get himself the hell out of there. I think this is okay. If he fires one of you two, I'm going too.
Yeah.
That way I know I can leave and they can't blame me for it. Yeah. That's what I'm going to do. Yeah. This may be more about Kelly looking for an exit.
Okay. So let's see what else we have this week. Trump is sabotaging ACA signups. He's trying to kill Obamacare.
Okay. I'm calling a flag on the play. Obamacare is now defined as a 6-week open enrollment period. My open enrollment period is 2 weeks. How about the rest of y'all?
Well, first of all, that's only one thing that they've done. And I don't know that I'll take you at what you just said, because I don't have the facts in front of me. If you say that they only that they just lowered it from
2 months to 6 weeks,
13 weeks. Is that what you're saying?
13 weeks with no pre-existing condition exclusions is insane. Insane. You can sign up anytime when you get sick and you have a 13-week open enrollment period, which means that it's going to roll back around, you know, sometime within the next 9 months. It should be shortened.
Okay, but I just want to understand what you said, Molly, because again, that particular fact I'm not up to speed on. So are you saying that they have changed that and shortened the enrollment period?
Yes.
And what was the number of weeks that you said?
I think it used to be 2 months and they put it down to 6 weeks, but it might have been 13.
It was three months.
They shortened it in half, but it's still double what everyone in the private sector gets.
Okay.
And they also, if memory serves, they reduced the advertising and the messaging.
90%, yes. 90%, so they have sabotaged
which,
right? I mean, but there's all kinds of data
Hang on, Molly.
Yeah,
Molly. No employer has decided. You know what? We're going to make sure that our employees are only 1/10 as aware of open enrollment as they were last year. I mean, no one has done
well.
That.
But this slush fund was going into these navigators.
The advertising budget is something that bothers me a bit more than the shortening of the open enrollment.
Marketing money was going into things like navigators that were, you know, paid tens of thousands of dollars to enroll like one person. I mean, the efficacy I will send you the link.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Please. I'd love to read it. Thank you.
Yeah, it was in the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, I mean the Wall Street Journal. It's no New York Times.
But. I could only go back to 2014 when I first signed up for Obamacare, and the navigator. We didn't use that term at the time. The person that answered the phones was essential, and they were really well trained, and they were patient, and they got a lot of people signed up. I look forward to reading this article that somebody claims to have found one instance someplace where one navigator got paid tens of thousands of dollars and only signed up one person. Maybe it happened. I don't know. I look forward to reading about it.
I think I read that one, and in the middle of it, they had
a TSA supervisor.
Yeah, they had to stop and answer the free Obama phone. And
right.
Yeah, exactly.
While they were eating their free government cheese.
So they were all eating free government cheese and yeah, exactly. And they were hiding the 30,000 Hillary emails. just kidding. I saw that.
I remember it. I remember it now. All of the Trump administration wanted to do all the advertisements that the Obama administration did earlier. But it accidentally got deleted in Jared and Ivanka's personal.
Boom!
That's what happened.
And you know what? Hey. That leads me to another thing that I wanted to discuss with everybody, which is some information came out this week about what DJ always refers to as the Russian Desinformatia. I can't even pronounce it.
Desinformatia. You're pretty close, though.
You have to let DJ intro this one.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. DJ, please tell us what happened this week. Thank you, Molly.
Yes, what has been revealed is that the Russian Desinformatia campaign had a particular branch aimed at Michigan and Wisconsin. Several sources have told the press that the Facebook ads that the Russian bots and Russian agents and Russian other friends of Vladimir Putin put in social media, largely to gin up outrage at various folks and convince people, can either convince left-wingers not to vote or centrist and right-wingers to vote for Donald Trump, had a particular interest in Michigan and Wisconsin, two of the Rust Belt three that went from Obama to Trump this time. And surprisingly to me, well, not surprisingly because everything else has been going on, there really hasn't been a whole lot of follow-up on how basically the entire Russian influencer apparatus decided it was a good idea to focus on these two particular states. It says two things. It says, one, that the Russian government in particular was very interested in really messing up our election, which is a warning because we have more elections coming. In Virginia, we have one next month. And of course, in their midterms next year, and there's 2020 and et cetera, et cetera. And the other one is that I just thought about this afternoon was who exactly told the Russians that it would be a good idea to focus on Michigan?
Well, that's the key. That what you just asked is the key to the entire Mueller case. And, you know, there's been some speculation. I think I mentioned this on the show, if not last week, I think recently, that, Jared Kushner has a company, one of the companies that he apparently is invested in or was working in, that was working with him, that micro-targets advertising and marketing, and they're like one of the leading companies in the country doing it, and they were part of the Trump campaign, and they were providing data to the Trump campaign to micro-target different ads, different messages to different parts of the electorate, all legal. Right? That's what they should be doing. But DJ, as you just pointed out, if they could ever show, if Mueller could ever show that that company was giving information to someone that was providing information to someone in Macedonia or someone in the Russian hierarchy to help them target it, well, that might be game, set, match in terms of the Mueller investigation finding either treasonous or potentially high crimes and or misdemeanors acts to prosecute.
What you might see is evidence of collusion with the Russian government and parts of the Trump campaign. It depends on how many layers they put between themselves and the actual folks who told the Russians, oh, by the way, you might want to look at Michigan and Wisconsin. I've always said that Vladimir Putin and his high-ranking aides are not stupid enough to include a loose cannon like Donald Trump in whatever the hell they're doing. But, you know, high-ranking folks in the Trump campaign, yeah, they may have been involved. I would be almost certain that Roger Stone had a hand in this. It would not surprise me if Paul Manafort had a hand in this. Whether or not that's enough to actually get to Donald Trump himself is an entirely different matter. But even if it's not, the more important thing here is that we have a hostile foreign power who is monkeying around in our elections, and they don't have to go through vote. They don't have to screw up voter rolls to do it, although they certainly love to, and we need to make sure they don't. You know, there are many, many ways for foreigners to influence our campaigns. Hell, we've done it on some other campaigns ourselves. Normally, they've been much more above board than this nonsense. So we just need to be more prepared, and we need an American people who are more cognizant of what is happening to them as they go into the polls.
Yeah.
That is first and foremost the most important thing.
Does everyone remember how close Michigan and Wisconsin were? Michigan was something like 10,000 votes out of
– Michigan was a quarter of a percent.
Right. Michigan was
Michigan was a quarter of a percent. Wisconsin was about two-thirds
Wisconsin was about 20,000. And, I mean, when you take – Michigan is almost 5 million people. I mean,
and the difference in Michigan was around 10,500.
Yeah, I mean, that's incredible. And if you think about just those ads had, if they had just a small impact, that's incredible.
I mean, okay, I think I need to take all things. First is the idea that somebody wanting to tinker with the election might focus on Wisconsin and Michigan, you know, is not exactly shocking unless, of course, you're a year of the Democratic campaign.
That's what I was thinking. How come they do it? But the Democratic National Committee apparently didn't know.
Yeah, but I mean, jokes aside, you know, if you looked at any list of swing states on U.S. media, those states were very prominent in the list. So I that's not a shock. Now, as to who came up with the idea of how to run these micro-targeting campaigns, who knows? Maybe they called someone at Facebook and asked them. I mean, Facebook doesn't seem to have been too interested in who was buying the ads until after the fact. So somebody, you know, working through a shell saying, hey, I'd like to focus on this. Can you help me punch the targeting out? Hey, that's good business practice for Facebook and
so
forth.
You're right. There's, I just speculated if they can tie it to the Trump campaign through Jared, through Manafort, through Roger Stone.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. I think the Russians are incredibly sophisticated. And if it turns out that the evidence shows that the Russians know just as much about micro-targeting American elections as our candidates do, I wouldn't be surprised at that either.
More.
the question we have, though, but that still leaves to a question for me as to why they were focused on, say, Michigan and Wisconsin and not, say, on North Carolina and Florida, which were much more well-known swing states. Florida in particular was considered the swingiest, if you will, of the swing states. What was it about Michigan? What was it about Michigan and Wisconsin? Wisconsin was barely on anybody. I mean, certainly wasn't on the administrator at all. But it was hardly on any. It really wasn't much on anyone else's radar very much. And Michigan, Michigan was something that people talked about. But I don't really know. Again, and it just gets us back to one of the reasons why the 2016 election was such a surprise. Is that, you know, Michigan and Wisconsin suddenly became battleground states where for the vast majority of Americans, they hadn't been.
Well, and when did this campaign take place? Because, you know, was this a sustained thing from, I'll just say, August through November, or was this the last 2 weeks of the campaign? I don't recall reading that.
My guess is that it was probably longer than the last 2 weeks, although I don't have anything in front of me to say that either. By the way, DJ, you know, I'm not sure that there's evidence yet that these same practices weren't happening in other swing states. I think the news reports.
To be fair, you're right. Absence of evidence is not necessarily
right. And I think the news reports focused on Wisconsin and Michigan because they happened to turn out to be, with Pennsylvania, the three key swing states that moved the election in favor of Donald Trump. However, I'll bet you that there was similar programs in place for a Virginia, for a North Carolina, for Florida, Colorado possibly, and we could probably, you know, New Hampshire maybe. We could probably name a couple of other states.
We probably can.
And people forget, by the way, the other thing that – I'm going a little off topic here, but it's on the last sure. – it's on the last 2 weeks of the campaign – 2 days before the Mueller letter to the congressional committee that was investigating the Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton was ahead by as much as 12 points in some national polls, and she had healthy leads in a lot of these swing states that she ended up losing. That campaign had to make a tactical decision. They thought they were going to win. They were wrong, but they thought they were going to win. And they thought, do we try to expand the map, not only for our campaign, but for future Democratic presidential campaigns, by going into Arizona, by going into Georgia? And they did. They made a calculation. And as you'll recall, they went into Arizona with, I think, 1 day's worth of campaign events. I think it was 2 events in 1 day. And that was time away from Wisconsin and time away from Michigan, where, yes, in retrospect, those would have been better places for them to campaign. But In the middle of a battle, right? And whether we're talking about a political battle or whether we're talking about an actual battle with guns, people make on-the-spot decisions, and sometimes those decisions are bad ones. It doesn't mean it was a bad campaign. It means they made an educated decision that didn't work out, and that happens in elections.
Okay, the more time people spend trying to leverage this information to relitigate the 2016 campaign, the less time we'll actually spend trying to make sure this shit doesn't happen in 2020. All right, the 2016 campaign is done. In a race that close, everything was responsible for her losing the election. Just everything, no matter what it is, no matter what it, whatever you the first 10 things you think of, they probably all were responsible. Let's actually focus on making sure this doesn't happen again in the future, because the more time we spend relitigating the past, the less time we spend ensuring that this doesn't happen again.
Yes, I mean we probably should be looking at legislation, I wouldn't say banning, but restricting the ability of, you know, or at least requiring disclosures of companies looking to run micro-targeted ads on social media, just in general, if only because, as we've noted, it's open to a lot of misuse and abuse that really wasn't on the table, 20, 30 years ago. If you wanted to influence the 1980 campaign, the way you would have had to do that would have been to basically buy TV ads with NBC or CBS or ABC.
Right. So let's see, what else is in the news this week? There's stuff that happened that actually doesn't have anything to do with Donald Trump, or at least overtly doesn't have to do with Donald Trump.
Not directly.
I understand there were tiki torches in Charlottesville again this past weekend. Who wants to talk to that?
Well, first of all, I thought we weren't talking about things that had to do with Donald Trump.
Well,
everything. Thank you. Mic drop.
So the KKK and UVA, is that what we saw?
Yeah, Mike Spencer and the quote white nationalist unquote crowd came back to UVA on Saturday night. They came with their tiki torches. They called it Charlottesville 3.0. because they think that makes them cool. They were only there for, I've seen some reports that they're only there for 15 minutes. I've seen some reports they were there for maybe about an hour, but it was the Nazi version of a flash mob, showing up with their tiki torches, chanting nonsense, and then going back home, wherever their mother's they call home. It's a reminder that this stuff is not going away, that these people have felt emboldened ever since last November, and certainly ever since they were told that some of them were very fine people. And it's just it's here in Virginia, where we have an election for governor and other statewide offices in 30 days. We are apparently ground zero for this sort of thing. You had this in Charlottesville at UVA, and then at my alma mater in William & Mary on the other side, a Black Lives Matter group shut down an ACLU speech and question and answer from an ACLU official because they were upset that the ACLU defended the white nationalists, as they are called, right to stage a rally in Charlottesville back in August, which of course went thoroughly violent. And there's all sorts of problems behind the attempt to keep them out of Charlottesville. One of them being that the folks who tried to stop the rally in court did not present the evidence that would have shown that some of these folks had very violent intentions. Why they didn't do that, I don't know. The folks at Black Lives Matter, William and Mary, seem to think that the best thing to do is to shut down the speech, which, again, that didn't really make sense to me. Although they did make a comment that they said liberalism is white supremacy, which actually dovetailed my New Deal is racist post.
Yeah.
So I have to give them credit for recognizing that.
Well, look, I understand the Black Lives Matter. I get it. You're either with us or against us is their mindset. And, and I'm not defending, but I get it. With them, they are in a system where supposedly their friends, the liberals, are actually one day saying, oh, you guys are great, we're with you. And then the next day, they're helping white supremacists. So who are they really helping? And I get it, because it kind of sucks. This chapter of Black Lives Matters, that's their nom de plume. That's their operation. That's the way they work. They shut things down. They get noticed.
We had a very similar incident here at the Pride Day parade. Black Lives Matter came in, and the police, made some arrests, and it's caused this rift between the gay and lesbian association in
LGBTQ
community in Columbus with Black Lives Matter that's still ongoing, 6 months later.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I at least tend to think that that a lot of these groups are making, I would say it's not even a tactical error, it's a strategic error, in that, there comes a point when, the ACLU is, if somebody's trying to shut down a Black Lives Matter group, is likely to come to bat for them, all else being equal. Rather than, going through the conventional strategy of forging alliances to, push their agenda forward, which is what you sort of saw early on. They are antagonizing everybody, and it's, at some point, I think they're running the risk that it's going to be, okay, we can't work with you, we're moving on. That people are just going to not bother to work with them.
But to be fair here, I mean, to sort of look at it from say the BLM perspective, and again, there are things the August Charlottesville situation, where it was pretty clear that a lot of those folks, and they openly stated it beforehand. They said, we're going to go, we're going to have a rally, and essentially we're going to beat some people up. Now, again, for me, the issue is when the city of Charlottesville tried to move the protest somewhere else to sort of defuse the situation. Why did nobody bother to tell the judge, oh, by the way, here we have these organizers talking about wanting to violence this thing up? That the ACLU will always defend speech, including unpopular speech, and that is right for them to do. But I think it is also fair for the Black Lives Matter folks to say, okay, look, you have spent this, we have watched over 200 odd years where everyone who's the best of the brightest, who tell us to be classical liberal, social liberal, New Deal liberal, who always tell us they have our best ideas at heart. And then two generations later, we look back and we go, oh, no, actually, wait, no, they didn't. They were just lying to us. I can understand the cynicism and distrust behind Black Lives Matter. I don't necessarily think shutting down people from speaking is the right way to do things. And I think Cliff is right, where it could not just be a tactical, but a strategic error. But I think those of us who want to see the issues that BLM raises be addressed and be addressed properly, we have to take into account that the African-American community has been sold a bill of goods on a lot of things for about as long as the Republic has been in existence, if not longer. And if we don't take that distrust into account, we're not helping.
Yeah, and anybody. I think another thing that should be pointed out is that protest and civic unrest is a messy business, and sometimes it's not so clear what the right thing to do is. I happen to think that Black Lives Matters had every right to shut down that ACLU speaker at William & Mary. But regardless of what I think—
Not under the code of conduct, they
well,
didn't.
Well, you may be right, Cliff. I actually don't know of their code of conduct, so I'm gonna take you at face value and say you're probably right on that regard. But my greater point was, you look back at the Vietnam War, and I think at this point, most people would agree that those people protesting the Vietnam War were right on some regard, that there was something happening in the United States in the highest levels of government that needed to be addressed because it was a war that was unwinnable. And I don't want to litigate the Vietnam War. Let me just make my point is that you had the SDS, you had the Weathermen. They were, they had quite often different strategies than some of the more mainstream protesters. You look at the civil rights days. You had Malcolm X, who was not really aligned with Martin Luther King. You had the Black Panthers, who had their own approach to how to get, you know, civil rights broadened in our society. Protest is not clean. And so when we assume that BLM aligns perfectly with the ACLU or aligns perfectly with Antifa, I think that's the mistake. And the truth is, all of this stuff is going to have to get worked out in the wash, and I look forward to seeing how it plays out.
There's a really good Woody Allen bit. I want to say it's in Manhattan, where he talks about, did you hear the Ku Klux Klan is over in New Jersey? And his group goes, you know, we should write a journal. We should write something in the New Yorker. And he goes, yeah, well, you know, what about getting some guys and going down there with some, you know, with a big pipes? And they go, you know, what would really get them is something in the Times that would really sting. He was like, or maybe like 10 guys with pipes, you know, and just get down there. And they were like, you know, maybe a satirical opinion piece that would really show them. And he goes, or maybe like 11 guys, and goes, just really get them. And everyone's like, oh, we should really, you know, talk to them. And yeah, and
I believe we, and I remember that. The bit, and I forget what movie, I think it was in Annie Hall, but I remember the bit where he's saying, you know, guys, so, you know, biting commentary has its place, but let me tell you, bats and pipes.
Yeah, that's the line. right.
And not that I'm
condoning violence.
And unless, speaking of
unless it's against Nazis.
Here's a transition. And speaking of violence and protest, our Vice President Mike Pence went to the violent NFL this week to take in a game. Who did he shoot? I know it's a crazy transition, but I'm trying to make this look like we think these things out.
So gotta get there what somehow.
Was he at the Pats game? Who was he seeing?
Colts game.
Indianapolis. It was the Colts game because he is from Indiana. So he was watching the Colts and the 49ers. And
please,
if I may hijack your intro, because I've been watching football all day today. A number of Niners players took the knee during the national anthem, and Mike Pence suddenly decided he wasn't interested in watching the rest of the game, and he left. And he said that he chose not to stay for the rest of the game because he was upset by 49ers players taking the knee and, as he put it, disrespecting the flag and disrespecting this, that, and the other. Personally, I think David French had the best description of this in his alternative headline of this. He said, "Vice President gets triggered, runs to safe space."
But I like that. I mean, this was all planned between Pence and Trump, that this was staged, that they expected that there was going to be at least one or a couple of players taking a knee, that he was going to make this move. And to me, it's clear that they are hoping to start a wave of people doing this to the NFL. And, you know, Molly, you're the economics expert, but let me ask you this. If I make $35,000, $40,000 a year, and I've shelled out $600 in tickets for me, my wife, and one of my kids to go to that NFL game that I've been thinking about for the last 6 months, am I walking out of the game just because Mike Pence did it and I don't like the fact that a couple of the players took a knee? Is that really – is there an economic – theory that shows that people are going to drop.
I think I see DJ getting a little excited too, because you know the theory that applies is sunk cost. So I mean, whether or not you can't get that money back, and so whether you or not you wish to stay, but no, I don't think that somebody's made that investment.
Once you pay the tickets, the cost is sunk. And the question is, will you enjoy the 3 hours of watching the game more than you will feeling like you are somehow connected with the president and vice president of the United States? I mean, to some extent, and I know this because I used to go to Jets games for 4 years when I was in high school. My dad was a season ticket holder, you know. Fans go to the games. They go more for each other than everybody else. They don't go for the players. I mean, as you know, Bill, I think it was Bill Simmons who said, "We root for the laundry now." because of all the free agents going back and forth. But it's not rooting for the laundry or rooting even for the team. It's about your fellow fans. It's about that community who's been watching that team, who's felt a connection with that team in games at that stadium. And if there are fans who would rather feel a connection with the president and vice president and all the folks who get all worked up about players taking a knee, then yeah, they're going to walk, they're going to go home, and they're going to hit the bar and probably watch the game on TV anyway and talk about how wonderful Americans they are for walking out of the stadium. But you know,
I'll go ahead and jump in here. I don't think you're going to see people walking out of the games a la Pence because of the sunk cost attachment. However, what you are seeing is in basically all the surveys and whatnot I'm seeing is that NFL viewership is down. The NFL is the least popular of all of the major sports. And there's a headline from Yahoo Finance. NFL advertisers are, quote unquote, nervous about ratings, comma, protests.
But NFL's been down. It was down before this.
You know, this is not helping.
Molly's got it. This is not helping a situation that's already been bad. Trying to disentangle one from the other, i.e. secular decline.
This is not helping. Weren't their ratings up?
No, they weren't.
They've been down all year. But
they've been down for like the past three years.
I would attest that to the quality of play, however, which for at least the first 3 weeks stunk.
I've been blaming Tim Tebow for like the because he sucks.
Well, but you know, I think Pence's act was more kabuki theater, and
that was me slapping the microphone with my hand as a simulation of head desking.
I agree with Molly. You know, my favorite part about the whole Pence thing is the picture he used for his Twitter picture saying, I'm leaving. I'm here at the Colts game was the same picture he used from a 2014 Colts game. He couldn't even be bothered to like take another picture of him sitting there. So he
But to be fair, Greg, there are a lot of Colts fans who are kind of wishing that they were still in 2014. So that may be the reason.
But he told the press pool and everyone they were like, "Hey, stay in the car. I'm only going to be gone for 10 minutes." And the press pool is already like, "We were told not to like leave. He was only going to be gone for 10 minutes, and it wasn't worth us all leaving and coming out."
They were playing the Niners, and he knew he was going to leave.
Fake news. It was fake news.
He knew he was going to leave if they knelt, and he knew they were playing the Niners, so he knew he was going to leave. But, I mean, it's the same thing. I think these millionaires kneeling is kabuki theater, too. So, I mean, whatever. I don't care. I don't care that he left. I don't care that they kneel. I just don't care.
Molly,
it's just feigned outrage. It's just feigned outrage. I mean, he knew what was going to happen, and he's like, "Oh my gosh, think of the children. I guess we should ban Fargo or something like that." You know, that's an obscure John Kasich reference for anyone who didn't get that because he's an asshole.
Okay, it's still over my head.
So that actually happened. I thought I was like, wait, I must be really drunk because I heard somebody saying NFL owners are banning.
No NFL team in Fargo.
No.
Exactly. No, that's why I was confused.
I wanted to get that under the wire. Right.
And now let's turn our attention from the national pastime, which is baseball actually, but from football and the NFL to Hollywood. Because what's a week without taking a pot shot at the liberal elites in Hollywood who love to sexually harass young ingenue actresses and then somehow blame it on Hillary Clinton, which I still haven't figured out that connection. But Harvey Weinstein,
it's about time.
The very successful movie mogul, was in the news this week and apparently has just been fired. Was he fired from his own company? How did that happen?
he was let go from the board.
I don't know how it happened?
He was let go from the board about an hour ago. Although it was when we started recording, so that might have been 3 hours ago, or 4 hours ago,
or 2 weeks ago. So somehow Harvey Weinstein was fired from his own company.
I have the statement here from the company, which I got from the Daily Mail, which I read so you don't have to. In light of new information about misconduct by Harvey Weinstein that has emerged in the past few days, the directors of the Weinstein Company, Robert Weinstein, his own brother, ouch, Lance Maroff, Richard Konigsberg, and Tarak Ben-Amar have determined and have informed Harvey Weinstein that his employment with the Weinstein Company is terminated effective immediately. Ooh.
Interesting. And he also lost an attorney this week because he was being represented by Lisa Bloom, who, by the way, I believe she was one of the attorneys who was prominent in representing some of the women that accused Donald Trump of some sexual misconduct.
Yes, and I think some of Cosby's victims as well.
And the Cosby people, thank you. That's also where I heard her name. Yeah. And yet, for some reason, she was defending Harvey Weinstein until somebody said to her, Lisa, this is the worst possible thing you can do for your career. You have to get on the right side of this issue.
Right.
And she did.
To have your lawyer fire you, that's bad.
That's bad. Wow. That's bad.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you guys think? Look, we're all totally unattached to the highest machinations of the movie industry and how people do business there. I mean, I've read some articles this week that said, well, Harvey was a product of a bygone era. I don't recall there was ever an era where it was okay to invite a young woman up to your hotel room, open your robe and say, hey, do me a solid and watch me take a shower. I don't know when that was appropriate.
Bill O'Reilly does.
I thought that was the whole story.
Nobody rushed in and said, well, Bill's from a different era or anything because he's not a big top, Democrat donor. So that's the issue people are making.
Hey,
I have said this before, usually at science fiction conventions, and I will say it here. Hollywood is a place where you will do very, very well if you are liberal, white, and male. If you don't match all three categories, you're not going to do very well. And by the way, even if you do match all three, it's more of a crapshoot. So I don't
know what Kevin Feeling has been saying. Hey, I'm white male. I did pretty well there.
I was going to say.
Go west, young man. Yeah,
then you don't feel slighted. My point is that there is that sliver of American culture, that niche is one that Hollywood understands very well. I would humbly submit it does not really understand everybody else, and therefore it has gotten by far more with luck than it should have. I don't think Harvey Weinstein is a product of a bygone era. Harvey Weinstein is a product of an era that unfortunately is still with us.
I agree, and go ahead, Cliff.
Yeah, I mean, what came to mind is the quote unquote bygone era bit is I'm reminded of in at least some fiction, occasionally referring to giving an aspiring young actress quote unquote the casting couch, which was to say getting the aspiring young actress to sleep with the director in order to, land a bit part.
Right.
Now, I'm not sure how much truth there was in that back in the 70s or even the 50s.
The 40s and the 50s, sure. Absolutely.
80s, absolutely. 90s. Sure. 2000s,
2010s. Yeah.
But I want to tell you guys one story, because to bring this back to the modern era, let me tell you a bit of gossip that I heard once that I didn't believe at the time, and I now believe it to be true. Harvey Weinstein, among the movies that he produced, was an Oscar-winning movie called Frida, starring Selma Hayek. And it was about a woman who was, I guess, a freedom fighter in Mexico in the 1800s or something like that. I didn't see the movie personally, but I heard the story that he came down to the set in Mexico while they were shooting and decided that they were so over budget that he was going to close down production in the middle of this movie. And he told Selma Hayek to come to his hotel room and convince him why he shouldn't shut down production on this movie that had gone way over budget. In the hotel room, he argues to her, one, I'm going to do it, and two, all those people out there that have been working on this production are going to be unemployed because of you, unless you sleep with me tonight. And the story is that people saw her emerging from Harvey's room the next morning really ticked off because apparently Harvey had used Viagra and kept her there for hours beyond what she anticipated.
I find it interesting that that would be what she was ticked off about.
So this morning on Meet the Press, Chuck Todd asked Senator Dianne Feinstein, going back, that since he is liberal, Weinstein is liberal, that he's contributed to her campaigns.
And many Democratic campaigns, including
many Democratic.
That's right.
Right, right. And he said, will you be giving back all the money he's giving you? And she said, did he give me money? I don't know. And he goes, well, Republicans have, the GOP said he has. And she looked at him and she said, I wasn't aware that he gave me money. And he goes, well, it seems like he's giving you quite a bit. She goes, well, I'm going to have to look into that. And so Chuck Todd keeps on pushing. And finally, she goes, I don't really know what you're talking about. And then finally, he goes, 20 years ago, he gave you money. And she stops. She goes, 20 years ago? Maybe. I don't think I still have it. But anyone who knows me knows that I'm kind of against all those things, but I will look into this. Sure. But I think that's going to be the new thing. So anyone who he's given money to in the past, 40 years?
I think I heard earlier this week that Chuck Schumer and a few other people are making arrangements to donate it to women's charities and causes and things like that.
And I think that's awesome. I think that's the way it should go.
Yeah. And I think it says something about how charmed a life Donald Trump lives, that this week surrounds the 1 year anniversary of the Access Hollywood tape, and we're talking about someone else grabbing pussies.
Right.
And with that, we want to thank everybody for listening. Please follow us on Twitter at MPU Podcast and on Facebook at facebook.com/moreperfectunionpodcast, and share our link on your Facebook timeline so your friends can discover us as well. And if you like talking politics and want to debate with us between shows, join us in our sister Facebook group, Open Fire Politics. We're all there, and we'd love to see you there too, so I can yell at you personally. And with that, is there anything that anybody wants to say after this extremely long and sometimes emotional podcast, but I think maybe also one of our better ones, I hope?
Let me see. We talked about guns, abortion, Vietnam. If we just talk about guns, abortion, and Vietnam in schools, I think we'll have everything next week.
Religion.
And throw in Viagra. Oh, we've got some Viagra in there, too.